This is an SEC oral histories interview with Andrew Klein, former director of the Division of Market Regulation at the Securities and Exchange Commission. Andrew, we're glad to have you here. Today, by the way, is October 15th, and the time is approximately 2:40.
I'm delighted to be here.
Andy, why did you choose to come to the SEC out of private practice, and when was that?
I came from a small firm in New York that was heavily involved in what used to be a staple for law firms, Securities Act practice, dealing for reporting companies, putting together underwriting documents for them, dealing with law firms, mergers, acquisitions, that sort of thing. I guess a substantial part of that work had, in terms of reporting obligations, preparation of proxy materials and periodic reports, had been in the hands of outside counsel for some time, but firms began to internalize that work, and I think it dented my firm, and I'm sure a number of others. An exciting part of that period for me was being involved in one of the very early takeover efforts by a client of ours, General Host Corporation, which went after Armour & Company. At that time, Skadden Arps wasn't much bigger than my little law firm, and we worked with them on that deal. Armour, of course, did not want to fall under the clutches of the dreadful Baker and sold itself to another enterprise, but it was quite an adventure in effort and new territory under the takeover laws. So I love that stuff. I love the SEC work that I got to do at that firm. And as the work began to drift away from it, I found myself up to my neck in leveraged lease financing of a large liquid gas carrier tankers for Japan lines and that sort of thing. This did not romance me at all. And fortuitously, a friend of mine had moved to Washington to become a legislative assistant to Congressman Dreiman, you might recall. And his brother was a staff member of the SEC. I visited Washington to see my friend in his great work for Congressman Dreiman. This was just prior to the days when President Nixon got into real trouble. And his friend, his brother, Arthur, introduced me to John Lifton. Indirectly. Arthur had heard me at a dinner party at his brother's house saying how terrific it was, Washington that is, and Northern Virginia compared to living in Manhattan. There was a favorable difference. John apparently at the SEC was looking for more New York type lawyers to try to bring down to the staff after he and Lee Picard and others stopped working for Chairman Casey and went down into the newly created Division of Market Regulation, which had been part of the Division of Trading and Markets when enforcement and market rate split. John and I met in New York. He came up to interview me. I took off doing some of this tanker financing stuff in London. My then wife was beating me over the head about staying in London too long, threatening to come over, pregnant as she was, on the next flight to Heathrow, and I was going to have to do something about it. But at the same time, John called me and told me that they wanted to hire me, and I've gotten it clear there's a GS-14 something or other. And so I remember sending a telegram back to my wife saying, "Don't come. Rent house. Find one in Washington." But that's how I came to work.
Your experience up until then had been in what I would call 33 Act work and some takeover work and the esoterics of tanker leases.
Exclusive.
And you ended up in a new division, the Division of Market Regulation, which was dealing with, or would eventually deal with, a new statute, which was, I think, probably by then wending its way through the Congress.
In pieces, it was.
In pieces, the 1975 Act amendments. And so it's an entirely new area that you're getting into.
It was all that. Yeah. The only thing I knew about the New York Stock Exchange was the Department of Stock List, where I had dealt with Mr. Grasso, who was then in charge of that department. That was it. That was my whole contact in securities trading. Um, well, and of course the impingement on activities during underwriting, but the 10b6 7-8 series imposed. But I had never had to really be involved with it. It was brand new. It was fascinating. The position that I had was that of special counsel under John Lipton, who was in charge of market structure. John, I gathered, although there may be other claimants to this, said that he was the author of the infamous, famous white paper of the SEC, a central market system. That's quite a piece of paper, actually. And I read that avidly. I was given Harvey Pitt's masterwork in transforming the proposing and adopting releases for regulations out of the SEC when he wrote his Rule 19b tome as chief counsel under the division of market regulation. We were fussing around with questions like foreign access to exchanges, an enormously institutional membership was something that Bill Casey had thought he'd put to bed, and then got involved in litigation with the Philadelphia Stock Exchange and institutions that had formed broker-dealers to join that exchange, which accepted them with open arms. Fixed commission rates were under attack. These were stopped sometimes of the newspapers, but fairly significant issues that were readily graspable, but with a sort of an establishment set of rules on exchanges and historical reluctances on the part of the commission to tamper with things, and indeed serious constraints on its authority under the then Exchange Act. But it was a lot of brand new material to read and to start to deal with, and I did that with some gusto. It was pretty interesting. It's interesting still.
Bill Casey was he still there when you got there?
He was out, and we were between chairmen. I think this was in the Brad Cook disgrace period. There was no chairman. We were anxiously waiting the arrival of Ray Garrett. From Chicago, who became a wonderful chairman of the commission, and his fellow commissioners, all a distinguished group.
And was Lee then the
Lee Picard was director of the division. He had, I think, two associate directors. One was John Lipton, and I have forgotten now who the, I guess Sheldon Rappaport was associate director. And would have been the one most intimately involved with such oversight of the self-regulatory organizations that the SEC maintained at that time, which was on feeble legs. It was not an elaborate program. And you'll recall that the SEC had a rule of questionable validity, I think, that finally required exchanges to actually file rules with them after they had been adopted. There was a curious practice of writing letters of non-objection to rules that exchanges would adopt. There was no procedure such as the onerous ones, and that is onerous today, where SROs are forced to file their rules for approval by the commission, and the rule either has to be approved as consistent with the act or rejected as not consistent. There was just all that apparatus was lacking. There was a little menu of things that the commission could become involved in with respect to the rules of exchanges under old Section 19. One of them, and it had taken years and years for them to figure out that they weren't doing a good job of it, was that the commission was to do such things by rules were necessary to assure that reasonable rates of commissions were fixed.
You used the word fixed.
Fixed. And after lots of hearings predating my arrival at the SEC, but we were in the middle of one when I did arrive, they made the last one. It turned into a hearing not just on commission rates, but on market structure. And I think the conclusion on the staff was, and ultimately the commission's conclusion was, they couldn't find a reasonable basis for fixed commissions. It's amazing to think that it took from 1934 until 1974 to figure that out, but it did.
Although some have said recently that the demise of fixed commissions is the cause of a lot of our problems in the markets today, because that took away a great source of income, and pushed the firms over to investment banking and other more lucrative ways of making money. And
it's hard to come up with a defense for why there should have been fixed rates and commissions. It's particularly hard to figure out why an institution, as it was in the old days before there was a discount. If you recall, we went to unfixed income commissions in a stage where there was something resembling a volume discount for institutions. But it was hard to see why a fellow trading 100,000 shares ought to pay the same commission as someone doing 100 shares. And there wasn't a sufficient explanation as to why it was that much more work to do the 100,000 share trade. Of course, it probably was a great deal more work to do the 100,000 share trade. But it's hard to put your finger on something that said, well, these people ought to be paying the same rate per share. It was just not a very rational structure and hard to defend. There's no doubt that there was an incredible consolidation in the securities industry after fixed commissions were eliminated. But there was consolidation in investment banking as well. There used to be a number of relatively small underwriters. I'm not sure they were living on fixed commissions, but perhaps they were. But big became the answer to how to do capital markets, and became the same answer for purposes of takeovers and mergers and acquisitions. And I think the finance became concentrated in New York to a degree that was probably had never been experienced in the United States before. But it's hard to blame it all on the unfixing of commissions. But the unfixing of commissions became a banner waved by all. You know, one of those things where it's very unpopular to defend the fixed commissions, the sort of monopoly rates charged by this monopoly institution, the New York Stock Exchange, as it was perceived as a monopoly institution. There weren't fixed rates for people trading over the counter. One wondered why it was so necessary to sustain life. Why grass would grow on Wall Street just because you unfix commissions. In fact, grass did grow everywhere else, but not on Wall Street. So that was a key economic element in breaking up the way the securities industry was structured before, no doubt about it. But there were other elements as well. I mean, the admission to, well, I suppose I should, instead of getting off on those separate issues, simply say that the Securities Act amendments of 1975 in separate pieces of legislation on the Senate side and in one unwieldy mass in H.R. 5050, the House legislation, did get at, in one way or another, all of the thorny issues of the day. It got after institutional membership, used to be a big deal. That's what I've referred to it before, is a way in which an institution, by forming an affiliated broker-dealer and joining an exchange, would basically beat the fixed rate, because it internalized it, put all the business through that ticket. Foreign access was a big deal. Well, as soon as you decided that you had to have rational standards of membership and not be discriminatory in giving people access to membership, it wasn't possible anymore to keep foreign broker-dealers off if they were willing to subject themselves to the U.S. broker-dealer regulation. It got at fixed commissions because they were barred by statute unless the SEC made certain findings, and the findings are impossible findings ever to reach. It sort of has to be, you can have fixed commissions back if that's the only way to save the known universe, and you have to find this in a non-the-record proceeding. Now, no one's ever taken on that challenge. It totally changed the way self-regulatory organizations work. Forcing them all to file their rules and to bear the burden of enforcing the Act, the Commission's rules under it, and their own rules, absent a reasonable justification or excuse, something that the Office of Compliance and Inspection Examination just loves these days. I think we're going around telling all exchanges they're not doing a good job of that. But there was no such lever. It was always, I was going to say, no such lever that the Commission used to have over self-regulatory organizations, so that the enforcement of self-regulatory organization rules never has been within the SEC's jurisdiction. They didn't have enough direct power over self-regulatory organizations, enough hooks on how they made changes and lived to really get them to do anything until the 75 Act amendments were passed. And they were necessary, as I think Stan Spoken would have put it. You've got to use you've got to leverage your influence with other people who can hire more people than the government can to do this job. And I think that's been somewhat more effective. since the 75 maximize. There are only really two securities regulators in addition to the commission today. I mean, that's the New York Stock Exchange and the NASD regulation.
And Elliott Spitzer.
And Elliott Spitzer, who is playing an interesting role from New York. So it turns out that not all of the self-regulatory organizations were ever actually asked to shoulder that enormous burden of regulation by their members. They were able to farm it out under agreements to those who had more money and more people to throw at the problem. And although they're still, the regional exchanges are still responsible for regulating their own floors, I'm expecting and enforcing with respect to that, all the rest of the business of the firms is really something the NASD and New York can enforce. But before, no one was enforcing any in any rigorous or regular way, and without satisfactory government oversight. So that law brought about very significant changes in infrastructure, the regulatory structure of the American securities markets. So it was tremendous to be in on that at the outset, dealing with those little pieces of legislation and helping write comments on them. And in fact, I think I probably wound up ultimately being at least a lead writer of all of the commission's testimony on those bills and on the 75 acts of menace as they finally emerged. And then it became my job on the staff with Bob Lewis, John Lifton had left, to implement them and merrily set about doing that. Of course, one of the great and mystical causes in the 75 acts of menace was the creation of a national market system. There are a wonderful set of principles laid out in Section 11A of the Act, each of which would seem to be in conflict with each of the others, but that all were somehow or another the purposes of Congress in embracing the idea of a national market system. And we went on to try to solve those problems. Some of them were informational, that is to say, getting at the consolidated tape of last sales, getting at the consolidated quote system. Those were ideas that had been in the hopper when I arrived in the slenderest of rules in the the thinnest of explanations, and I think Herb Pollack was probably behind their initial drafting of that. And we wrote somewhat more complicated rules. We had gone through a long war with the New York Stock Exchange, primarily to force them to become part of to one way or another, figure out how to work with the other exchanges to produce a consolidated collection of last sale information and disseminate it on a real-time basis. We went through the same exercise with quotations. So that actually got done. We were concerned about where brokers had directed orders, something that preoccupies everybody to this minute. We initially thought that maybe there was a way to force broker dealers to take into account. We were very naive in a lot of ways. The understanding of really how the business works is something the staff can eventually be persuaded of, but it started out with ideas of its own, probably should.
Yeah, when you came there, you and most of the other people in the division, which was a new division, were reasonably young and not experienced in this kind of regulation. Shelley Rappaport was probably the institutional memory of the division.
He was. He and Marty Moskow. they were. There was, of course, the 1961 special study to rely upon. There's a good deal of interesting material on that study. And what was true in 1961 was very much still the case in the early 70s. So there was stuff to read. There were people who had published this or that article, economists and other people trying to kick the machine in one way or another. But there were all these popular targets. I mean, the targets were fixed commissions. Target was a lack of adequate market information in the hands of anybody but the people inside the club. Problems of exclusion of people from being able to participate, at least as members in the markets. The other old sawhorse was offshore trading rules, which constrained competition by members of exchanges in being able to transact and listed securities offboard. That last one took up quite a lot of time to try to unlock. And it has been now. It has now finally fallen away almost of its own accord after decades of fencing over whether or not that served some valuable purpose. And in doing that, and then dealing with growth of the over-the-counter market, as NASDAQ came on, you saw the disappearance of independent brokers over-the-counter. Everyone internalized their order flow, dealing only with their own customers, and giving them whatever executions they could get away with that would make their over-the-counter operations as profitable as possible. And it's with those latter problems, the problems of internalization and the problems of best execution, that I think have been a special problem for the Commission in the intervening decades after I left. We thought that might be a meaningful solution when I was back there by figuring out how to compel brokers to direct their orders to the best market. Well, how are we going to know what that was? Worry about how to define it, how to define best execution. And began serious chewing on those issues, which is, if they had been simple, I would have thought they'd have been solved earlier than now. I don't think they've been solved today. But people are farther ahead, I think, and they're thinking about it. And technology had to catch up. We thought technology might be able to do everything in the 70s. Well, it probably is almost capable of doing everything now, but it certainly wasn't then. So the ideas were a little ahead of what was feasible to ask for at that time. But gosh, it was a great adventure.
Yeah, how many terms did you serve under while you were there?
Well, as director, only under Harold Williams. Before that, Ray Garrett would have became chairman after I arrived as special counsel. We have in the middle there. I forgot who succeeded Ray.
Rod Hills.
Who?
Rod Hills.
Rod Hills, exactly. And then I think Rod was succeeded by Harold. So, yes.
Ray Garrett wasn't a market person. He was actually come out of the public utility holding company when he was at the group, when he was at the commission. Did he just sort of give Mark and Ray his head and let them go? Or?
Well, that would be putting it too strongly. As I mentioned, there was as a result of the fixed commission rate hearings and market structure inquiries that were ongoing before I even got there. And that went through the whole process of formulating Securities Act amendments. There was enormous complexity and growth to all of these ideas that got some resolution in some direction in the Securities Act amendments. But it was hard to come on board as chairman with all that a chairman has to do and somehow suddenly become expert in all those things. I mean, that wasn't realistic to ask for. I've often thought of asking Harvey, but I'm not sure I get a candid answer. That he must remember being there through much of all of that stuff. Does he regard himself to this day, as an expert in those things? I think it must be hard, even for him as a chairman, to have a handle on complicated interlocking things that are going on in the securities trading markets. The division seemed to have such experts as there were, people who thought about it longer than other people. There was conflict within the division at that time when I was with the staff. Everybody could take a shot at any idea. I mean, there's been cross memoranda written by all the divisions about any idea that interested anybody that went in front of the commission. There was a sort of a discipline in the staff where you didn't run off and try to do wild things in the commission's name without having the commission's direction to do so. There was delegated authority, but perhaps not as broadly as authority has been delegated in the last 10 or 15 years. So communication with the commission, with the chairman and the commissioners generally happened with some frequency. When there was an issue where you really had to go one way or another and you'd be supposed to explain it to the commission, everybody had a crack at it, and it wasn't perceived that a chairman's direction as a policy setter was much needed. Those policies had been worked out before. You had finally just gotten them embodied in a statute. And I suppose the first thing a new chairman who didn't know anything about the topic thought of doing was to say, well, I actually have some different principles in mind. Maybe they shouldn't be the ones Congress just spent time enacting. So people were sort of reading from a congressional script. And there hadn't been enough time yet for things to be worked out so that one could say, well, there's another way to construe that and another way to try to administer that. that. Certainly Rod Hills was positioned, I think, to do that, so timing that. And then you got a fellow like Harold Williams, who was a brilliant man, and his great contribution to the market structure was to decide early in his chairmanship that the most important issue we should be dealing with is a definition of what a qualified securities were. There's a piece of this Exchange Act that says that, that only securities qualified for trading in a national market system, and that they should, a whole bunch of new rules, set of rules and principles should be developed to apply to them, and they should apply across all markets once you're able to qualify securities. Well, this led to some sort of disorder in the over-the-counter market, who were absolutely certain that not all of their securities would be viewed as qualified. Well, no kidding. But the NASD got very upset about that, and successfully, as far as I can tell, lobbied Harold Williams, saying the bottom, everyone will join an exchange. We're never going to be, you know, we'll be discredited if you don't do something to make the securities that are traded OTC into, quote, qualified securities. So the very first national market system thing that Harold ever asked me to do after appointing me director was to say, you got to have a definition of national market system securities to include, you know, most of these OTC securities. And he would say, well, Harold, that's a very funny end of the problem to go at first. You don't even know how you want to force these things to trade, okay? Why would you want to say, okay, you're a prince and you're a prince and you're a prince, but you don't know what kind of trading we're going to have to support? Well, that didn't seem very important to him, and that was somewhat remote, whereas the NASD pressure to get all of their companies designated as, quote, qualified. It's very important to that project. So we got off on that sort of a footing. Also, we were well advanced, I think, in pulling the slats out from under exchange off-board trading rules. And that's another one that the New York Stock Exchange, not alone, but signaling, did not want to have happen. And I think Harold got the feeling that was going a little too fast. I seem to remember he had a hearing, perhaps on the House side, reviewing the implementation of the Securities Act Amendments of 75, and was questioned harshly about, well, you know, why aren't you making more progress on this and that, and why haven't you gotten rid of those off-board trading rules? He said, look, I'm not going to be chairman of the SEC and go do something radical that I'm not sure is going to work or understand completely, and then come back to you and say, I'm sorry, the wheels fell off. Well, that was a reasonable summary action, actually. Although there were those of us in the division who were quite willing to pull the wheels off and thought it would be just fine. We seem to still be just fine now, so I'm not sure it was worth 20 years of delay. There it is.
Well, it sometimes takes 20 years to reform.
And then
by that time, the industry is so far ahead of you that you've got to reform something else.
Absolutely.
Do you have fond memories of your days at the SEC?
I do. My jobs at the SEC were the best I've ever had. I enjoyed the work, the client, the public interest. Those with whom one had to contend, either on a friendly or not so friendly basis, but all pretty able and unselfish participants in the process. It was a wonderful process, rulemaking and dealing with the stuff that's in the commission's charge. I'm not sure I did like it as much today as I liked it then. I have a feeling that things are more compartmentalized now within the commission. The divisions have less to do with each other, feel less free to criticize other people's ideas. That there's a kind of a set piece quality to the way things are presented to the commission today that was not characteristic of the way the commission worked before the advent of the Sunshine Act. Perhaps for all I know, dealing with the commission and enforcement matters, which are conducted behind closed doors, is the same sort of food fight we occasionally got into back in the 70s. But that was part of the fun of it. And that seems drained out of the more formal rulemaking and interpretive processes that now take place in public. But I enjoyed it very, very much. And I've told anyone who's ever considered working there that they will enjoy it, I hope, as much as I did. It's not often you get to represent an unselfish client that gives you almost as much time as you could ever need in some things. And that's what the SEC has.
It seems that these days they don't have as much time as they need to solve problems. They're sort of reacting to what's going on in the marketplace and corporate America.
Well, there is a certain shrillness about that because amateurs have taken up the cudgel. They, you know, the, I mean, I can't imagine what people actually think. Do they think that everybody just became a crook, like, you know, last year or just a couple of years ago, or, you know, that they were, that Bill Clinton was, I don't know what they think, really. Much of this, I'm sure, has been going on for a long time. Much of it should have been foreseeable. If you're going to, if big pension funds, for example, are going to start to become critical of executive compensation and start pounding the desk about how that ought to be linked to stock performance, I mean, what greater invitation to cook the books to drive stock performance could you have? But no one seems to have even thought of it. But now they're perfectly willing to, you know, hammer any regulator who gets within their gun sights and say, well, you should have thought of it. It's done something about it in advance. Popular ideas often get propelled into reality without careful thought. It's not the commission's job, you know, though, to do that. The commission is not the regulator of executive compensation. We don't have a federal corporate statute. We don't have common standards. We seem to have some nolent states in charge of those things. And the boards of directors seem not to have taken their responsibilities very seriously. And chief executive officers, a number of them, seem to have felt that they could steal with both hands as long as they couldn't be thrown out of their jobs. Wall Street's always had a little taste of that in investment banking, and that doesn't surprise anybody either. The SEC and the exchanges perhaps can be faulted. The exchanges don't really regulate that. The underwriting process. That's always been the NASD does, but only to a marginal degree. With respect to who gets the goodies, if it's a goodie, and how much compensation is too much. But there's some sort of fundamental ethical failure in the marketing of deals that were internally ridiculed and sold to people anyway. So somebody's to blame for that. But probably there's been enough blame about that to go around for the last couple of decades, maybe back extending to my time.
I was going to ask whether there were similar problems back in the days that you and I were.
Well, it's hard to imagine that there weren't, but you know, I found when I left the commission, a reason for leaving, in addition to finally deciding that my kids were sold and I couldn't figure out how I was going to possibly give them the educations that I wanted to try to do that on a government salary and continue on that kind of thing, I found I was becoming a bureaucrat. And here, my little definition of a bureaucrat is a guy who has an agenda, maybe a very powerful agenda, and he may believe in it very deeply. But nothing else can get on the agenda because he's got things 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and those things he absolutely wants to get done. And you tell him, no, you know, there's really something else that ought to be number two. And you stop listening. You become unreceptive to that. Well, I thought I was getting there, and that was part of a reason for leaving. So on my agenda, this sort of problem never got on the radar screen for me. And I don't think for any of my fellows on the staff. It's not that we believe that investment bankers were men of sweetness and goodwill, or that corporate executives were just sort of naturally not thieves. I just don't think we knew quite how to get at it. The accounting and, worrying about accounting was something that was part and parcel of your old division, but not of anybody else's. And the office of the chief accountant was sort of a remote, distant, cold place that none of us understood. So it was hard to get involved in those ideas, and maybe it's just as hard today.
Well, I remember, this may have been before your time, but Nick Wilson, who was a professor at the University of Connecticut, I think, law school, and I ran some hearings on so-called hot issue securities markets.
Sure.
And in a very small universe, there were a lot of the problems that you see today with the way hot issues were being marketed. Not that the commission ever did very much with that, but the study was there.
Well, it does seem shocking, you know, when it takes the Attorney General of the State of New York to come up with a list to show you how multimillionaires made multimillions more to give investment banking business to firms that in turn gave them hot new issues. I mean, it does make you feel kind of dumb, you know, if that's been going on all this time, but no one noticed, no one told us, you know, no one tipped us off, because that doesn't smell right. And I suspect that if that had come to the attention of the staff in the earlier day, something would have been done about it. I just don't think it did. We were told about lots of stuff. You know, we always took pros on the street sometimes to say, say, you know, let me tell you what's really going on here, how this works. And there were plenty of people willing to do it. So I don't want to call them informants. It's not that they're informants. There are people who saw practices in the brokerage industry, in the professional trading world, that they thought were wrong. And they had some good reasons. And managed to put enough knowledge into the staff to generate sufficient debate to turn over the idea whether that was right or wrong. It surprised me if there weren't people like that out of my corporate finance side as well. And you know, the staff's got to learn this stuff somehow, somewhere. We don't run special studies like the 61 study anymore. You can't hire a huge professional staff and pay it well enough and give it a couple of years to go write things up for you and get the sort of information that was obtainable back then. I mean, I read today, you know, you read the congressional hearings on the operations of the stock markets back around the time the Exchange Act was adopted, and you read these, what these witnesses had to say, and you just say, doesn't this guy have a lawyer? So, you know, he really shouldn't be saying that sort of thing. Couldn't a guy like figure out how to tell him how to say that different? Well, I feel maybe some of the same thing was going on in 61. A little less of it when we did the option study while I was there. And maybe today everybody's smart enough to just keep their mouths shut. But it used to be a good source of information. Here, somehow or another, the synapse never got closed.
Yeah, it used to amaze me when Gene Rothberg was at the commission, who worked on the special study, and he could get the old monarchs of Wall Street to tell him
sure.
How things were really working.
Sure.
And it always amazed me that they would tell it, because either they felt that the commission was a paper tiger and it didn't matter whether they told them that or not, or they were public spirited. I don't know which.
Well, it's, you know, I had years ago, I got maybe the 50th reunion of the SEC or something. There were one of the people attending was a specialist from the New York Stock Exchange. And he came up to me and said, you know, Andy, this is really a great occasion because. At the New York Stock Exchange, before there was an SEC, we were really nothing. We were just nothing. We were just people who collected there and did this trading. And now we're important. Now we have standing. You know, now we have authority. And it's all happened under the aegis of the SEC. Well, I think that's probably true. And things have... there were always people in the industry, I think, who said, you know, there's a way to make money, but there's a right way to do it. And that when morally the thing started to fall too far out of bed, some of them couldn't stand it. They thought it ought to be done differently. And who better to talk to than your friend at the SEC, whoever that was. And I hope that's the case today, that Gene, some of these stories are frightening. What's frightening about it is how many different linked people doing different things it took to get to the end of the money line. These characters. It wasn't just a CEO, it was the CEO and the CFO and the Treasury Department and the underwriters and the accountants and the lawyers, and it took them all.
And the commercial bank.
To get there. And without the cooperation of all of them, just one guy spotting the stuff and deciding, I can't stand this, it all would have fallen apart. We don't seem to have that one guy. That's unbelievable to me. I don't think that is true in yesterday, but it sure seems true today. No, I don't mean to sound bitter about it. That just surprises me. How could so many, you know, upright guys close their eyes and put on blinders to such a degree as to make this possible? I don't. Someday someone will explain that to me, but I don't get it now. And I don't think it was that way in the securities industry when we got a much broader and tougher regulatory grip on them than the commission had before. I think people were still pretty forthcoming.
Do you recall humorous moments at the SEC?
Several, though I'm not sure that they should be publicized. But I'll tell you a little humorous vignette. Harold Williams did say to me somewhere early in his chairmanship and my being director that he understood the Cincinnati Stock Exchange was in deep trouble and was going to go under. He didn't want to have an exchange go under on his watch, and that I should do something about it. So, at that time, Don Wheaton, who may be remembered as the gigantic gadfly of Wall Street, and who, by teaching the commission so many lessons about how important competition was and everything else, functionally destroyed his own business because other people did just what he said. They became more competitive, and then there was no more weeding. But he enjoyed it. But he was, one of his last cracks at staying alive in the world was a trading system that he had. And he said, this is so simple, you know, you can really arrange trading system to do all this trading. You don't need all these people and all this stuff. And he had worked something out with the Cincinnati Stock Exchange where they would use his automated trading system. And the question, and they were so busted they couldn't have lawyers and they had to deal with all this stuff and they had to write some rules and get all this stuff. And so the staff was, how shall I say, of assistance in getting that done. And Catherine McGrath at that time was associate director in charge of the SRO. And by golly, they formulated their rules, put it in, turned on their machine to just the consternation and damnation of all the rest of the securities trading world and the idea of machine trading was just anathema to all the other exchanges. And I remember a small bunch of roses showing up for Kathy's desk, and I'm sure those came from Mr. Wheaton, though I'm never sure that was the person from whom they came. And within the year, Harold said, I wish I'd never said that to you, because the Cincinnati Stock Exchange caused so much trouble from a market structure and sort of social acceptability within the securities industry standpoint. But there were a few others. I remember we got new authority over banks in the municipal securities area, and there were supposed to be cooperation with the bank regulators, of course, consultation. And the staff had decided to go in and do an inspection of some bank up in Buffalo. And so we're all ready, you know, to have the guys drive over there in the car and walk in and say, give me your records. I want to see all this stuff going on. And we called up the controller or whoever it was from the chairman's office. I think Harvey was in on this call. We said, well, we're consulting with you. We're going to send inspectors into this bank up here. We're going to do that this morning. So you're going to do what? I said, well, you know, we have the authority to do that. And the thing, and we're supposed to consult you. We are consulting you. Because that's, you know, we'll share the information with you. And I said, well, you're not going in there. So yeah, we are going in there. And I cannot remember whether the inspectors were turned away at the door or what, but that was the very first chapter in SEC bank regulated cooperation in the municipal securities area. It was a complete flop. There was no cooperation, whatever. So I remember that. I'm sure there were many of them were more private.
Well, we need to go into the private ones in this discussion. You ultimately decided that you would leave, and I think you've probably pretty well covered that. But
I did.
Did you have misgivings when you left?
Oh, misgivings in the nature of a job not finished, not well done. Haven't won all the arguments. Didn't know what would happen now. Didn't really know who my successor would be. We had, I think by that time, Lloyd had left.
Lloyd Fowler?
Lloyd Fowler had left. Kathy had left. So, Harvey, of course, had left years before. Ralph was, I think, still there as general counsel.
Ralph Ferrar.
Yes. But a lot of the, you left. A lot of folks who I considered to sort of be the heavyweights that grew up with or admired when I got there, had departed. It was time to go. So, and I didn't know who that next generation was going to be or what it would be like. And it worked out. I also was, I spent college and law school out of Chicago, and I really was very attracted to Shin because Milton was still active as a partner and, of course, an author for a special study. These guys had given birth to this Chicago Board Options Exchange and the Options Clearing Corporation. And it was a little, back in the 70s, the idea that you might have market regulation as the main string to your bow in trying to go into private practice was probably an odd idea. And it was odd in most firms, but Schiff was not one of them. And so I did join them and moved out to Chicago again for 2 years before I got to the firm in Washington. And I had more trepidation about moving out to Chicago probably than anything else. Because I'm, like it or not, I'm an Easterner and I belong here.
So. Okay, is there anything you'd like to add?
No, haven't I? a series of things that have happened in the last 2 years affecting the markets that seem to me to be wrong. But the first thing that was really wrong, what they've done, is decide that a self-regulatory organization is perfectly all right for an SRO to become a for-profit business. That is a dreadful, dreadful mistake. The profit motive should not be what a self-regulatory organization is about. It is charged with quasi-governmental power over people. And self-regulation always meant something where the members of the organization have some sort of ultimate role in how the thing is running itself, under principles laid out in the statute. But, if things became too expensive to the members, they could throw out the menu, find somebody else, replace them. And it was a notion of there are standards in the industry, and it is us. We are the maintainers of the standards. If we can't find them among ourselves, there won't be any. And they're running a good discipline. So I think it's been a terrible error to decide that somehow have people in there to own the thing and make money out of tape revenues and that sort of stuff, and that's a good reason for existence. No matter what you do to try to bundle up and protect the regulatory enforcement process, I don't think it can work quite the way it was supposed to under these circumstances. So I regard all that as an error. I regard the creation of ECNs as an error. To tell you that Burr Rissman and I wrote a letter to the SEC 12 years ago when they first did the Security Pacific no-action letter permitting a little mechanized computer-driven trading system that was to do OTC options in government bonds to do something without being regarded as a securities exchange. And we didn't write it for anybody. We wrote it because we thought that was such a terrible idea. That should be allowed to operate without being subjected to all the responsibilities of an exchange. You can't just be an exchange because you decide to open one in your garage. There are very elaborate principles that govern them and the things that they have to do. And the idea that this was a way around and out of all of that seemed absurd. It seemed to me to kick the archstone out of the exchange. Well, the staff and the commission vigorously defended that decision over the course of the next 10 years, I think, through a litigation in the Seventh Circuit with the Board of Trade, and the decision was 2-1, I guess, against the idea that the commission had ever, should not have tolerated such a thing. It ultimately was forced indirectly to make a finding that it wasn't an exchange, that it was a bad thing. But anyway, the commission became dug in its heels to defend the decision made at the staff level in the no action level. That, of course, was reversed when they adopted Regulation ATS, which defined these things as exchanges. The light finally dawns, okay? But then said, but never mind. You still don't have to be really an exchange as long as you obey this other little set of rules we've worked out. Well, they're inadequate. They don't establish any good level playing field with the SROs. And they have given rise to other horrors. The idea that, Island is a client of my law firm, so I don't wish to speak against their interests, but I can't help but comment on how odd it is that Island should not be compelled to obey the trade through rules of the NASD just like all the other children, or that somehow or another it's free to have a great market in the Hughes 20-30%, whatever it is, but that they don't put quotes out and nobody does anything to them. What kind of a world is that? So that's wrong. Because the rebates of fees for market information, that used to be a discount from the bill that was sent to you by the SRO, but now they'll send you a check. And how hard is it to start to think about in tremendously liquid issues that have a spread of 2 or 3 cents, but you can earn, what is an Amex print worth today? $12, $20 per print? That you can trade all day long and lose and pick up those discounts. Is that what ought to be the reason for trades appearing on our markets today? These are obvious things. Nothing's been done about it. I didn't invent them today. So someone should do something about all those things. And there are other things, but I don't regard market regulation as today as a thing that's easy to look at and say it's being operated in the is being, the regulation is being done now in the public interest to the best of everybody's abilities.
I don't know what they're doing.
I think they're trying to work out business deals between conflicting systems of trading and trying to accommodate everybody and not have to make decisions, you know, about outcomes. And if they look to the statute for what those outcomes should be, if they don't feel it got in the proper direction, then go back to Congress again. But just the idea of doing nothing about some of these things is wrong to me.
Well, you said they probably can't afford another special study. Could they? Is it time for another special study?
Well, I don't think these things are that hard. I doubt very much that they're that hard. You've got enough staff that understands enough about these things. It's not for lack of facts that you don't know how to proceed. It seems for lack of being able to make a decision. Well, as we all know, that's making a decision. Competition is a good thing. No one intended competition to take over in the markets. That's a raw idea. It was always supposed to be fair competition. That actually has a meaning. People shouldn't be afraid of it. There's a lot of stuff going on out there that I can't believe is invisible and that I can't believe is taking so long to address publicly and forcefully in a way that's correct for the markets. I don't have suggestions as to what's right. I just think that there's but what I've just described ought not to be the case.
Well, thank you, Andy.
You're
it's a pleasure having you here for this interview. And we'll close up at about 3:45.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you.